to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. During the next 3 weeks, we'll be offering three of our favorite shows from 2005 while we take a short holiday break and prepare for a new season of interviews and commentaries. During the week of July 18th, we mark the 80th anniversary of Tennessee versus John Thomas Scopes, better known as the Monkey Trial, the best-known court case in American history pitting proponents and opponents of teaching evolution in the schools. We aired a conversation between Talking History's John Herron and Edward Larson, the author of Summer for the Gods, The Scopes Trial and America's Continuing Debate Over Science and Religion. We also heard from William Ashworth, who set the record straight on testimony by William Jennings Bryan at the Scopes Trial, and Fiona Beatty, who told us about a website full of information on this and other trials. We pick it up with my weekly segment, History in the News, for the week of July 18th, 2005. In a recent article in the New York Times, Susan Jacoby, director of the Center for Inquiry, Metro New York, reports that historian Frederick Lewis Allen was wrong when he concluded shortly after the 1925 Scopes monkey trial that fundamentalism was permanently discredited by the prosecution in Dayton, Tennessee, of John T. Scopes, who had taught his biology students about Darwin's theory of evolution. The error in this statement, she points out, is demonstrated by the persistent determination of anti-evolution crusaders to force public school science classes to give equal time to religiously based speculation about the origins of life, most recently under the guise of intelligent design in the state of Kansas. Jacoby writes that many liberals mistakenly believe that these controversies are largely a product of the post-1980 politicization of the Christian right, when in fact, opponents of teaching evolution in the schools are really the heirs of 8 decades of fundamentalist campaigning against Darwin through backdoor pressure on textbook publishers and school officials. She adds, however, that at the beginning of the 20th century, America was well on its way to an accommodation between science and mainstream religion, now a fait accompli in the rest of the world. A growing number of Americans accepted both evolution and religion, but considered it the responsibility of the church, not the public schools, to sort out the role of God. The Scopes trial changed all that, Jacoby concludes. Instead of being the nail in the coffin of creationism, as many believe, the trial undermined the emerging accommodation between religion and science by intensifying the fundamentalist conviction that acceptance of evolution would inevitably weaken any type of faith. In a moment, our guest Edward Larson weighs in on the subject when he discusses the Scopes trial with Talking History's John Herron. It has been called the trial of the century and described as 6 days that shook the world. The reference is to the Scopes trial, which is the subject of John Herron's interview with historian Edward Larson.
On July 10, 1925, the case of Tennessee versus John Thomas Scopes, better known as the Scopes Monkey Trial, opened in the small town of Dayton, Tennessee. It would be the best-known clash before the courts over the teaching of evolution in America's schools. But as our guest this week illustrates, in the process, this trial took on a life and a meaning all of its own. He is Edward Larson, professor of history and law at the University of Georgia and author of Summer for the Gods, The Scopes Trial and America's Continuing Debate Over Science and Religion. Welcome, Edward.
Hello.
Well, let's set the stage for the Scopes Trial. We can probably jump back more than 6 decades, I guess, to Charles Darwin and his 1859 Origin of Species. And although the debate over what Darwin wrote began literally almost immediately, it took years for that clash to reach a fever pitch and decades more for evolution in the schools to be taken up by the courts. So what happened in the interim? What led up to the trial?
The trial took place in 1925. The anti-evolution crusade in America, the battle over whether evolution should be taught in America's public school, really began in earnest in that same decade, early in the 1920s. This should not be surprising, though, because that's the first time that most Americans started going to high school. Compulsory attendance laws really didn't apply to high schools before that time. There really wasn't a broad network of public high schools. People went to grade school, grammar school, as it was called, but that went through eighth grade, and nobody teaches evolution in grammar school. It was when most of America's teenagers began going under compulsory attendance laws to public schools, and there they encountered the theory of evolution in their biology classrooms, which was hands down the dominant theory of evolution by that time. Every high school textbook was strictly evolutionary in its tone and had been since the late 1800s. But it's when America's teenagers, America's public school children encountered that issue that the opposition really began in earnest as a public crusade against the teaching of evolution in public schools.
Why Dayton? Why the small town of Tennessee?
Well, that's just a little bit of chance and a little bit of opportunism in a local town. William Jennings Bryan, who was already a legendary figure in American politics by that time, he'd been nominated by the Democrats for president three times, starting in the late 1800s and again in the early 1900s. He was a major figure on the stage. He'd been Secretary of State. He was a theologically conservative Christian, but a politically liberal, progressive populist. He took a deep dislike of the theory of evolution for its social Darwinian implications. He didn't mind about the theory of evolution in general, that most animals evolve. What he cared about was the notion that people evolve in a Darwinian process, that is, a survival of the fittest competitive process. He saw that as one of the justifications used by the robber barons for promoting the exploitation of labor. He saw that tied up in World War I materialism and militarism, which he opposed. And so when public schools were teaching this, and when he thought that this was both undermining his view of a good society plus religious beliefs of the school children, he went on a crusade beginning about 1921, nationwide, campaigning for restrictions on the teaching of the Darwinian theory of human evolution in public schools. He went all across the country. This was a national issue. It just happened that Tennessee was the first state that passed a law to literally outlaw the teaching of human evolution in public schools. Now, other states had passed restrictions already, thanks to Bryan's crusade, which pulled in a wide collection of supporters, but mostly from conservative religious groups. So Tennessee passed this law, and when it did so in the spring of 1925, that was national news. Because it was part of a nationwide campaign, there had been near misses in other states, people were following this, and here Bryan had a victory. Well, when that happened, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, which had been opposing this legislation throughout the country, when one of these laws passed, it immediately offered to defend any teacher, any Tennessee teacher willing to challenge this law in court. That offer was read by, well, what you'd call civic boosters, local hucksters and promoters in the town of Dayton, Tennessee, which thought this could put Dayton on the map. This could be a major event. This could draw reporters and observers from around the country to see our town. It would bring in immediate business by tourist business and reporters coming to town, and it might have a long-term effect by putting Dayton on the map that we can make something of the town. So an opponent of the law, a local person who didn't like the law and had written letters opposing to it, he was running the local mills in town, he was from the north, he got together with some of the other people in the town, Southerners, including the president of the local school board, the superintendent of schools, the city attorney, and they all hatched this scheme to indict one of their own school teachers, a volunteer, mind you, whose job was never threatened, a popular local school teacher. John Scopes voluntarily agreed to be their guinea pig, and they were going to stage a trial, which was really as much a debate. They were envisioning and as much of debate as it was a trial over the wisdom of this law. They even invited H.G. Wells to come in, who was then the British novelist who was probably the world's most famous evolutionist promoter of evolution at the time. They invited him to come in and defend Scopes. That's what they were thinking of, a big show event to put Dayton on the map.
Well, you mentioned Brian, but he clearly wasn't the only star on this stage. Clarence Darrow also was in Dayton. How did that come about?
There were two of the brightest stars in the American firmament at that time. Probably the two most famous speakers at the time were William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow. William Jennings Bryan didn't originally intend to come to Dayton. How he got there, and of course him getting there leads to Darrow, when he heard about this test case in Dayton, orchestrated by local civic boosters and the American Civil Liberties Union, it looked like a way to destroy his law, to undermine it, to ridicule it. And so he volunteered to come down and join the prosecution to make sure they did their job and defended this law as a good thing, because he thought, of course, it was a good thing. Well, when William Jennings Bryan volunteered to join the prosecution, Clarence Darrow signed up for the defense. At the time, Clarence Darrow was not only the most famous trial lawyer in America, he was a master of the cross-examination, of making closing arguments. His trials were nationally famous. When he was trying usually a famous and wealthy murderer, who he was usually defending, all the nation would watch because of his skill in the courtroom. He had just tried the Leopold Loeb case the year before, which involved two wealthy Chicago teenagers who had murdered one of their classmates on a dare, basically, and he had orchestrated the defense, front-page news around the country. He was also famous as what you'd call an anti-cleric. He opposed religious influences in American laws. He had long crusaded against things like prohibition and legal restrictions on sexual freedom, for stopping school prayer, for not having Sunday closing laws. And when William Jennings Bryan volunteered to defend this law in court, Clarence Darrow couldn't resist the temptation of volunteering to join the defense. It was the first time in his entire life Clarence Darrow had volunteered free legal aid.
Did the two men know each other before the trial, or was there any kind of relationship that Darrow and Bryan had?
There was a long-standing relationship between Clarence Darrow and William Jennings Bryan. Both were traditionally Democrats. Both were on the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. They'd first gotten to know each other in 1896 when Bryan was nominated by the Democratic Party to be president of the United States. Clarence Darrow that year was running for Congress in Chicago. He had the Democratic nomination for Congress in what was considered a safe Democratic seat. He was so committed to the national ticket, though, that he spent most of his time campaigning for Bryan and for the national ticket and ended up losing his own race by just a couple hundred votes. So they had gotten to know each other then. They had crusaded together over the years for labor rights, the rights of workers. They had both opposed Americans' entry into World War I and gone on the speaking tour in that respect. So they'd known each other for years. They knew they were allies on a lot of political issues, and they were friendly, but they had always known that their religious views, that the underlying source of their liberalism was fundamentally different. Bryan was a Christian liberal, and Darrow was very much a secular liberal.
Well, the trial itself would last only 6 days, and much of that time was spent trying to figure out just what would actually be on trial. You just mentioned that the case was probably more a debate than actually a trial. Tell us about that.
Originally, William Jennings Bryan viewed the opportunity of going to Dayton as he called it, a battle royal for evolution. He wasn't a practicing lawyer. He hadn't practiced law for 20, 30 years. He'd been a prosecuting attorney early in his career before he was elected to Congress, but that was way back in the early 1890s. And he hadn't practiced law ever since it. He'd been a lecturer or a speaker. And he saw the trial as a podium, as a bully pulpit, one might say, where he could argue the merits of popular control over public education and explain why he viewed evolution, or at least the Darwinian theory of human evolution, as not a fit subject for teaching in high schools. Now, he viewed it in that way, and he was going to make it more of an argument, a public argument, than an argument to the jury. In fact, he didn't even care whether Scopes was convicted. Before he came into town, he volunteered to pay this fine for John Scopes. What he wanted to do was uphold the justice of his law. So in response to that, the defense decided to bring in top experts from around the country, from places like the University of Chicago and Princeton, top universities, Johns Hopkins University, both theologians, liberal theologians, and scientists that would argue for the scientific merits of evolution theory and also would argue that it does not necessarily conflict with a broad and sincere reading of Scripture. So they were going to argue on those fronts and open it up into what was thought to be a trial that would take weeks, if not months. Brian didn't have any luck in finding a similarly distinguished band of experts to defend creationism or attack evolution or take the opposite position. So the state changed its strategy. The prosecution changed its strategy in midstream and decided instead to simply argue that the law is the law. This is what the people passed. The law is clear and Scopes clearly violated it. And therefore, he should be convicted. And tried to exclude all sorts of expert witnesses because they thought they'd lose the battle of the experts. Brian instead would make his arguments against evolution and for public control of the high school curriculum. He would make those arguments in the evening and in side speeches to the assembled reporters and the assembled crowds, not in the classroom. So they made a shift. And so the trial was largely a battle over could the state preclude, simply introduce evidence that Scopes had taught evolution and shut off any other debate.
Hmm. Well, how did the public react to the eventual verdict in this case?
There was a mixed reaction, as best I can tell. Now, where I get that conclusion is, in the course of researching my book, I looked at any reports I could find from the time of reactions to the trial. And they weren't hard to find because this was literally front page news in every paper in the country. It was broadcast nationally, the first broadcast trial. The whole trial was filmed. Everybody was following it. It was also sent overseas, widely followed in Europe. So when it was over, virtually every newspaper in the United States wrote an editorial giving their spin on what they thought had happened. And there's not a single newspaper in the entire country that viewed this trial was decisive. Basically, the view was that both sides had gotten in their licks, that Darrow and the defense team had made a very, very strong case. And certainly, the press had been very sympathetic to their viewpoint, particularly H.L. Mencken, the famous reporter of the day who wrote scathing reports out of Dayton. So you had this coming out. But Brian had also very effectively made his case. The American legal system is a funny thing, the adversarial legal system. You end up getting two sides, each presenting their side, their own facts. And the process ends up, instead of reconciling them, driving them further apart, because in any trial, they both are wedded to their own viewpoint. Here in this case, what happened was that both sides effectively communicated their message. Oh, maybe not well enough to win any converts on the other side, but to excite their own audience and to build their own base and to convince those predisposed already to their position that this was a critical issue, an issue worth fighting for. When you think about it, why should teaching evolution be that important an issue? There are lots of issues that could be important to these two sides. Brian and Darrow were able to explain to the American people why this is an issue worth fighting for. And it's a testimony to the effectiveness of these two men as orators that 80 years later, their arguments are still resonating throughout the country from Kansas to the uttermost parts of this continent.
Well, thank you very much, Edward. I have been speaking with Edward Larson, professor of history and law at the University of Georgia and author of Summer for the Gods, The Scopes Trial and America's Continuing Debate Over Science and Religion. This is Talking History.
Now I'm the king of the swingers, oh, the jungle VIP. I've reached the top and had to stop, and that's what's bothering me. I wanna be a man cub, and stroll right into town,
and be just like the other men. I'm tired of mugging around. Oh, ooby-doo, I want to be like you. I want to walk like you, talk like you. You see it's true. An ape like me can learn to be human too.
As our guest commentator this week, William Ashworth, notes, it was the defining moment in the Scopes trial, that moment during which William Jennings Bryan, attorney for the prosecution and star witness, addressed the court to explain his objection to the way evolution was represented in the biology textbook John T. Scopes was using in the classroom. Ashworth argues that the testimony was misrepresented in the press by the most prominent reporter covering the trial, H.L. Mencken.
H.L. Mencken claimed that during the Scopes trial, William Jennings Bryan denied that man is a mammal. This is not quite accurate, but what Bryan did say is illuminating. According to the transcript, Bryan was showing the court the textbook that Scopes used to teach evolution to his class, and Bryan had opened it to a diagram that displayed an evolutionary tree of life, with branches leading to insects, birds, etc. This tree had a novel feature. Each branch ended with a circular label, and the size of each circle was proportional to the number of species represented by that branch. For example, the insect circle was huge, as big as an old silver dollar, but the mammal circle, at the top, was only the size of a small letter O. Bryan had great fun with this diagram. 360,000 insects, he said. Two-thirds of all the species of all the animal world are insects. And sometimes, in the summertime, we feel that we become intimately acquainted with them. Then there are the amphibia. I don't know whether they have not yet decided to come out or have almost decided to go back. As the courtroom rocked again and again with laughter, Bryan worked his way up the diagram. Finally, he came to the mammals. And then we have mammals, 3,500, and there is a little circle, and man is in the circle. Find him. Find man. Talk about putting Daniel in the lion's den. How dare those scientists put man in a little ring like that, with lions and tigers and everything that is bad? Tell me that the parents of this day have not any right to declare that children are not to be taught this doctrine, shall not be taken down from the high plane upon which God put man. So you see, Bryan did not deny that man is a mammal. What Bryan objected to was the idea that man is only a mammal. In Bryan's view, man was made in God's image, and he believed that we could learn nothing from a diagram that did not give humans a special place. A circle for mammals was not enough. It is interesting to compare Bryan's reaction with that of a younger contemporary, J.B.S. Haldane. Haldane was a biologist and a committed evolutionist, and in the 1920s was one of the first to work on the problem of the origin of life. Haldane was also a religious man, but his view of God did not much resemble Bryan's. For Haldane, God revealed himself through nature as well as Scripture. He was once asked, "What can you conclude as to the nature of the Creator from a study of his creation?" Haldane must have had in mind a diagram very similar to the one Bryan showed to the court that day, but Haldane was able to see in that diagram something Bryan could never have seen. And Haldane answered, "An inordinate fondness for beetles." God spoke to Haldane quite differently than he spoke to Bryan.
You've been listening to William Ashworth, professor of history at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and consultant for the history of science at the Linda Hall Library of Science, Engineering, and Technology. This is Talking History.
I don't know what to say, the monkey won't do. I don't know what to say, the monkey won't do. One Saturday morning I woke up late. I found a little monkey outside me gate. I went outside to investigate. The monkey was doing the latest dance craze. I don't know what to say, the monkey won't do. I don't know what to say, the monkey won't do. when I dance this cat monkey dance it too. And when I wash wash monkey wash wash too.
And finally, as promised, we turn to Talking History's Fiona Beatty, who will tell you about one of the most extensive websites around on famous trials, including that of Tennessee versus John Thomas Scopes.
What do the trial of Socrates, the Charles Manson trial, and the Scopes Monkey trial have in common? Answer: they are all featured on the University of Missouri, Kansas City Professor of Law Douglas Linder's famous trials website. There's over 30 trials explored in great detail, spanning from ancient to modern, from the United States to across the Atlantic, and it receives over 1 million hits a month. The information included on each trial is broad-ranging, varied, and interesting to students and the general public alike, with comics, fun facts, and games, to transcripts, appellate opinion, audio clips, primary documents, essays, maps, and pictures. The multidimensional presentation of the world of the courtroom works well, as exemplified by the Scopes trial. Besides an excellent introduction, there's a comprehensive menu taking the visitor from the Genesis, pun intended, of the matter, to the anti-evolution statute, excerpts from Genesis, scans from the textbook used by Scopes, Hunter's Civic Biology, to the trial itself, including Mencken's account, Linder's selection of highlights from the transcript, video clips, appellate decisions, and reflections from John Scopes, and much, much more. The site is well worth multiple visits. More trials are on the way. Clinton's impeachment trial is currently under construction, and there are over 30 trials to choose from. To find out more, go to umkc.edu/famous trials.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beatty, producer. Alex Smith, our studio engineer. And that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.
Steeple at 40.